Well, it's a fact of reality that we cannot control the outcomes in our life.
Yeah.
Whether we sink a putt every time or make a basket or find love or even success.
Mm-hmm.
But we can control our efforts. And by making a good effort over time, we definitely increase the odds of reaching our desired goals over not making the effort. So in a way, effort is success because that's all we can control.
Born in 92 on the block with the sharks. Cut from a different cloth, y'all would get ripped apart. You want a diamond, then you gotta get it in the dark. We dropping nuggets like Carmelo went to Rucker Park. Now we eating from state to state, we scrape the plate. I put my eggs in a basket, took a leap of faith. I took a chance, now we growing, see the impact. Decoding success with special guests, now let's bring Matt.
Welcome back to the Decoding Success Podcast, top 1% globally ranked show. Thanks to you. We are so excited to have you here yet again. And I want to give you your kudos, your flowers for showing up for yourself, because you could be doing anything else in the world, watching Netflix, listening to one of the other 300,000 plus active podcasts in this world. But you chose this one. And today we have a very special guest joining us, someone that has formerly joined the show. He's bringing his talents, his wisdom, his word, his expertise, his heart, all of that back to each and every one of you that's tuned into this. The gentleman joining us is a former world champion athlete, Stanford University gymnastics coach, martial arts instructor, and Oberlin College professor. His 18 books are published in 29 languages. His first book, Way of the Peaceful Warrior, was adapted to film in 2006. Incredible movie. I absolutely love the movie, so if you have not watched it, please do. Over a span of 40 years in 32 countries, Dan has taught the Peaceful Warrior's Way, a practical approach to living an aware, purposeful, and healthful life. We are joined today by Dan Millman. But Dan, as mentioned, I have a couple of words that I want to add. I believe you are an individual of stoicism. I genuinely mean that. I believe you are also an individual who walks in purpose. An individual who gives from his heart. This individual is Dan Millman. So excited to have you here, Dan.
Well, thank you for personalizing that intro, Matt.
I genuinely mean it, because as I mentioned, you know, just as we were catching up here and having some conversation to start, you know, last night I think I watched about 5 interviews of you, like most recent interviews. I might have even gone back 2 years from your interview with Lewis on the School of Greatness. And I'm like, just watching you as a person more than listening to you. Right. I think when we just watch someone's body language, someone's demeanor, someone's tone, or hear or pick up on tonalities, or watch for energy. That's what I got from you. Like, you have such a stoic approach to life.
Well, it's so nice that we could do this in person in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm so glad. And thank you again for being here. I genuinely mean that. We last had an interview in 2022. Two years ago.
We must be having fun, because time's just a fly.
Time's flying.
Yes, it is.
What do you think is the biggest change in your life, maybe a lesson, from 2022 to now in that two-year period of time?
Well, it probably centers around our grandchildren, just seeing them grow.
Okay.
And rediscovering that childhood from the innocence of a babe, and I may even bring that example up later, seeing them learn about the world.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's like reliving a childhood experience. So, yeah, because we came here for the grandchildren and 2 daughters who live here from California.
Yeah.
And so our lives are really pretty much grandchild-centered today.
What can we do to rekindle that childlike self, right, that we oftentimes lose due to adulthood, due to the seriousness we attach to life? And of course, I understand we need to meet our needs of especially living in an
of
area
course.
Like this, right? I mean, you have to make money.
Right.
You have to have a job, you know, or have a way to make money, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
How do we refine that or rekindle that childlikeness to ourselves?
Well, that's an interesting question. Pablo Picasso said, "It took me a long time to learn to paint like a child," to recapture that. And there was another writer named Barbara Rasp who wrote the the lesson is simple, the student is complicated. Whereas children's lives are not that complicated.
Yeah.
And they have a real focus. They can completely focus on things because their minds aren't yet busy and distracted until the teenage years when the mind starts getting very busy.
Yeah.
So I think looking into the eyes of children, if one has them around and it's appropriate, because we have elder role models, but it's important to have young role models too, and take those qualities and remember, a part of us can remember what it was like. And we look back and into those simpler days, but it was really simpler minds.
Yeah.
And it gives a sense of perspective too, what's really important.
Yeah. I love that you share that. The fact that, yes, it's great to have mentors, role models that are older, but equally as important as the ones that are younger.
Yes.
I think about it. I don't have children, nor do I have grandchildren, obviously, but my friends have children. And any time I am around their children, there is a sense of presence like no other. Mm-hmm. It is nearly impossible for me, at least, to hear a child's laugh as I'm in the presence of that child. Like, this just happened to me 2 weeks ago. I was at a communion party. And this child's laugh, one of my best friends, he, you know, it's his second born, and he has a laugh that's so infectious, and it's nearly impossible not to laugh hearing his laugh. Mm. You know, like that young energy is, it's magical.
It is. And of course, people don't have to have kids.
Yeah.
There are children around.
Sure.
So that's what's nice about the streets of Brooklyn, too, because we see everybody out on the street.
Oh, absolutely.
It's not just everybody locked away in cars driving somewhere.
Absolutely. You know what? I went to go grab breakfast this morning, and I'm like, it's a beautiful day out.
Yes.
Right? It's gorgeous today, out. Yeah. It's absolutely gorgeous out. But I went to go grab breakfast, and the streets were buzzing.
Mm-hmm.
There were strollers going. There were dogs walking. You know, there was just so much happening, and it's like, wow, like what a vibrant place, you know?
And Brooklyn, of course, like New York City in general,
yeah,
and all the boroughs, is littered, it's crowded, it's noisy, and everyone wants to live here.
Yeah.
Because it's stimulating, because the whole world is here. Though I have noticed three cultures that don't really like or understand each other very well. Bicyclists, drivers, and pedestrians.
That's great. I'm curious, knowing how stimulating this area is, New York in general, how do we create the inverse of that stimulus? Like, while living here, right? That's something that I try to do. I know that you've personally have done sensory deprivation in the past, right? I listened to that in an interview last night.
Mm-hmm.
I've done it in like float tanks and things of that sort, but even beyond that, right? Because those are a little extracurricular. Like, how do we create the inverse of the stimulus while being in a place like New York?
Yes, people do need to chill out. They need to balance their lives. And I'm glad you asked that because I often recommend that people create their own inner sanctuary. It can be done. You can just take a few moments to sit somewhere and imagine. And it can change, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But you can actually build it piece by piece. Each time you revisit it, it can be on a mountaintop in our imagination. It can be under the sea in a grotto.
Mm-hmm.
It can be in a forest, but somewhere meaningful to us. And we can actually start looking at the details almost as if we're creating something from nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And we can visit that place. I've meditated on the subway.
That's challenging.
Not always recommended, but it takes, you know, the time, but it makes the time, the journey go quickly.
Yeah.
So one can do it at any point in time, unless one is driving, of course, or on a bike. But that's how we can find that place to chill out. And I recommend finding a park, even if it's a garden, even if it's a backyard with some living things in it, plants, and reconnecting with nature. The Japanese call it forest bathing.
Mm, I love that.
Yeah.
You know, funny enough, I've been taking my pup. I have a dog. His name's Draco. He's about to be 4 years old. And I've been taking him on a pack walk every Saturday. And he loves it, right?
Oh,
he absolutely loves it. He's with the other dogs. They're walking in a collaborative group. And I love seeing him happy. But you just like you sparked this in me to realize that it's not just him loving it. I've really loved it because we're walking through the forest. Mm-hmm. Like we're walking through the forest, and at a certain point we get so deep in the forest that you cannot hear anything other than nature. Mm-hmm. Just this past Saturday, and listen, I'm born and raised in Queens. You know, like it's hustle bustle, 10 minutes from the city, like, you know, just on. And just this past weekend when we were there, it was just him and I. The pack didn't come this time. It was canceled. But I'm like, dude, let's just go. Like, let's go for this walk. And all we heard were the bushes bristling, chipmunks popping out of holes. I guess, you know, this is their season to come about. Like, it was just so great to disconnect, more so without having to pay for the sensory deprivation. You know, like, without having to invest, like, just taking in what's available by creation, you
right.
know?
Right. One of my daughters and her husband are birders, avid birders, and okay. they really go in and study nature and pay attention and notice the different birds and the bird sounds. Many people are into that.
Yeah.
And, of course, I see swans. And I mean, can you imagine Manhattan without Central Park? It's the heart of the
right,
city.
Right,
right. Many people don't know, but there are many small parks, too, around Washington yeah. Square Park and all around. And where most people live, hopefully, they have a park nearby at least.
Mm-hmm.
We have Prospect Park here in Brooklyn.
Gorgeous.
And I was there this morning.
Yeah.
So that's another thing, being close to nature. And, by the way, I mentioned children, but you also mentioned animals. Dogs, cats, we learn from them too.
Oh, I cannot tell you how much I've learned mm-hmm. from this little guy, you know. And I think there's a similarity to the infectious-like energy, the playfulness of a young child, as well as a dog. Like, I say this jokingly because sometimes it's annoying, but like I'll be sitting at my desk getting work done, and next thing you know, I have the squeaky toy or the ball being pushed up against my leg, like, hey, let's go in the backyard and play, you know?
Right.
And it, now that I'm having this conversation with you, I realize, like, hey, Matt, it's less of something to get annoyed about and more so something to realize, like, hey, maybe this is a sign from God for you to disconnect right now.
Time to play.
Time to play.
Right, exactly.
Time to play.
Yeah.
You know?
Now, I don't know. If I were a listener right now, I'd be going, this is great. I'm enjoying the conversation, but let's get some substance, you know. And I want to jump to Decoding Success because I love the name of your show and the theme.
I appreciate
Decoding
that.
Decoding it. Reengineering, reverse engineering.
Yeah.
And I had some thoughts about this. I don't know if you want to jump
in. You mentioned that via email. Absolutely. Yeah. Let's have a conversation. What are your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I think the first question for me about success is, successful at what?
Mm.
Because many people like the idea of success.
Yeah.
It means the achievement of a goal, I suppose. But I think we're all being very successful at being who we are right now. And we need to appreciate that too.
Mm-hmm.
To me, ideals are what we're striving toward. Reality is who and how we are now.
Okay.
So, I have a different view of the idea of success than many people, perhaps. But to me, I would define success as making progress toward a meaningful goal,
mm-hmm.
not just the destination. Because if we're aiming to climb a mountain, in a sense, we could say we fail with every step because we haven't reached the top yet.
Yeah.
But if we define success as every step in the right direction, then we can pat ourselves on the back. Hey, I just had a little success.
Mm-hmm.
There's another one. So to me, I believe we're, as you heard me say before probably, or write, because I've written 3 books about life purpose.
Yeah.
I think we're hardwired gold seekers. And again, coming back to the granddaughter, when she was crawling, still that age, she wasn't doing it for a workout, to get a workout in, you know. She wanted her older brother's toy. So she had an aim. She had a goal. That's why she was crawling in the direction she was. And even from that age, I think we're the happiest when we're moving toward a goal.
Mm.
From our point A, we need a point B. And in the Peaceful Warrior movie, there's a scene where my character, Dan, played by Scott Meklowitz, I just contacted Scott through Instagram the other day.
Awesome.
We reconnected since 2006. And so Scott, playing Dan, has this revelation. He says, Socrates, after the hike up this big hill, I just realized it's not the destination that makes us happy. It's the journey. Mm. And there's some wisdom in that, of course, because most of our lives are spent on the journey. But without a destination in mind, there is no journey. Mm. We just wander around. So that's why we need to have something we're moving toward. There are people who are lost, who don't really have the self-concept or the hope of reaching a positive goal. So maybe they become fanatics, zealots, because at least it gives them some purpose. Mm-hmm. They join a mission, a larger mission, and they can be drawn in by anybody that promises, you know, a righteous mission, whatever that may be. But if we can choose a positive purpose, in fact, a man named Shoma Morita, a Japanese psychiatrist, had three guidelines for living wisely and well, being successful, if you will. Mm-hmm. He said, accept your thoughts and feelings, whatever they are, positive or negative, as natural to you in that moment. Hmm. And by accept, he meant, as we might in meditation, just notice them. Mm-hmm. They're there. We accept them. We embrace them. Yeah. We don't have to follow them, avoid them, resist them. Just notice. That's what's coming up for me now. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm experiencing. The second guideline, though, is what is your purpose? What are you moving toward? What do you want? That's a very important question for many of us. And the third is do what needs to be done in at least a small step in line with your purpose. Mm-hmm. And I've been drawn to that. No matter what you're feeling, whether you're confident or not, whether you're motivated or not, do what needs to be done in line with your purpose. And, you know, I wrote one book called The Four Purposes of Life, and that goes into four different purposes and all that, and we could touch upon it if you like. But the most important purpose is the one in this moment. Because I may not know my cosmic purpose, what I'm ultimately here for, or you are here for, but I do know my purpose right now, sharing with you, having a conversation. You know your purpose. So we always know our purpose in each moment. And by making progress toward that, that I would view as a small success. That's why I recommend people dream big, but start small and then connect the dots.
I love what you just shared at the end there. I loved a lot of what you shared. In fact, I'm taking some notes here to make sure that we're touching on this stuff. But I love how you shared how having essentially a focus on the micro, the moment, this moment, it's essentially easier for you to know your purpose if you focus on the micro.
Right.
I love that. I absolutely love that. But I want to go back to the top of something you said, right, in regards to success here. When it comes to pursuing success, whatever that may be for someone, when I started this show back in 2018, in 2018, I think I was 26 years old. Mm-hmm. I did not know that I was operating from a place of achieving success that was skewed, meaning I was pursuing success or what I thought success was in a way that wasn't healthy because I was seeking the validation, the approval, the et cetera, et cetera. What I'm getting at with this is how important is it for someone to understand what they deem as successful and what they've been taught is successful through their conditioning.
Right.
Right. Through mom wants you to be a lawyer. Dad wants you to be this, like that type of stuff. Like, talk to me about that.
Well, yes, I'd love to. What all the psychological, educational, spiritual, religious traditions agree upon is the importance of self-knowledge. Mm. If we don't know ourselves, we end up making the right decision for the wrong person, the one we thought we were. And many of us have experienced that in relationships, choices, or career choices. Yeah. And it takes a while to get to know ourselves. Mm-hmm. It takes testing against the world. Usually it's at least 10 years after we finish our formal schooling and get out into the world. And specifically, it's knowing what are my talents, what am I good at and not good at, what are my values and what are my interests? Mm-hmm. And many people, as you just pointed out, mistake their interests for what they think they should or someone else thinks they should do. Well, that would be a good thing to do, but it has nothing to do with their actual interests, what they love doing or like doing. And the second thing is knowing our talents, what we're good at and not good at, is many people struggle to do things because someone else thinks it would be good that they're not all that good at, and to find their talents. One example, there was a great story, a true story, about this kid named Sparky who really wasn't very good in school. Mm-hmm. He got C's, mostly kind of mediocre. He wasn't horrible, wasn't failing, but not very good in school. And in sports, he was usually chosen close to last for the teams. He just wasn't that coordinated. He also wasn't that popular. It's not that people didn't like him, but they just kind of didn't notice he was there. Mm-hmm. But one thing he loved doing was cartooning. He'd do doodles. Mm-hmm. And he'd always cartoon and draw, try to draw different pictures. And finally, in high school, he submitted to the school paper some cartoons he'd done, but they were rejected. But he didn't let that stop him. He kept drawing. And he ended up drawing this character named Charlie Brown and Lucy and Pigpen and Linus. And I think he was making about $40 million a year because he stuck with the thing he was good at.
Yeah.
And so we need to find what we're good at. What's my talent, my interests, and my values? And that can take a while. Mm. What's really important to me? What do I value? And if we know those things, we can make wiser decisions for our lives.
Should we always pursue what we're good at as our quote-unquote purpose or definition of success? Like, just being good at something, does that mean like, hey, pursue this?
Well, not if we're not interested. Some people are good at something, but they're not really interested in it.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't match their values. So it's really I believe peaceful warriors, and that's all of us, really.
Right.
We're all peaceful warriors in training,
Striving
to live with a peaceful heart, but acknowledging there are times we need a warrior's spirit to march into daily life. And there are times that we, I believe we can make good money doing what we find appropriate or enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
While serving other people. All three of those are important.
Yeah.
And that's our task. And I, you know, in one of the books, I go into the difference between career and calling. Mm-hmm. And career is what we make, as you mentioned before, we have to make an income doing
it. Sure.
And some people say, but I love my work and I love the colleagues I work with and it's meaningful and it's valuable and that's all great. But if we weren't getting paid for it, we'd have to find something else.
Absolutely.
It's a fundamental human, since civilization started, trading our skills, our values, a product, something we make for an income.
Yeah.
Now, the calling is different. A calling can be as lighthearted as a hobby, something we just like to do in our spare time. It can be a mission, something we just are drawn to without explaining why. When I discovered an old trampoline at a summer camp, the other kids would jump and go off and do something else. I would keep jumping.
Yeah.
I loved doing it. And it, who knows, you know, who knew it would lead to what it did? But so we have to find out, you know, that about ourselves. And nobody loves necessarily everything about their work, but if it's appropriate to us, and reasonably enjoyable, then most of it is something that we find meaningful, then that will work for us over time. Now, the calling is different. Calling may not make any money ever.
Mm.
If it's playing guitar, if it's bird watching, if it's doing something else, are we just knitting? Whatever it is, people, it's something they enjoy doing in their spare time.
Mm-hmm.
And many people, well, the reason it's important to understand the difference between career and calling is there are a lot of starving young artists who don't want to quote unquote sell out.
Yeah.
And they say, I have to practice my guitar all day. And meanwhile, they're living in their parents' basement. And if they had a day job, they might get some sense of independence.
Mm.
And then they could still practice the guitar. So that helps them to understand their calling doesn't have to become a career. That would be nice if it does, of course. I used to tell my daughters, you know, do what you love and get someone to pay you for it. But that may be idealistic advice, even though it's still good advice. So I think, again, this whole idea of success in what? Our calling, our career? I think, now, how do we know if our calling and our career are the same thing?
Yeah.
Easy. If we won the lottery, would we keep doing what we're doing?
Simple question.
Yeah. And if we'd quit the next day, then it's just a job.
Yeah.
But if we would keep doing it, then it's also a calling for us.
I love that.
Yeah.
When you say calling, I'm curious to learn, Dan, do you feel like calling is aligned with what God, source, greater power, whatever someone might refer to it as, has put on you? Is that what calling is?
That's a good distinction. I like that. It may, because the idea of a calling, we think of a calling for the clergy, a calling in the church, but I view it as just something we're drawn to.
Okay.
And it may be predetermined. Okay. It may be hardwired in us before our birth. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
And how we were shaped. And different people find different things fascinating.
Yeah.
So that's in the sense, I mean, it could be a religious calling.
Sure.
But it could be calling to the military. It could be calling to any aspect of life.
Okay.
And sometimes it's turned into a career and sometimes it's not. And mm-hmm. that's okay.
You know, another thing that really piqued my interest before was when you were mentioning the importance of accepting feelings, right? You know, you mentioned a meditative state and accepting what's there, right?
Yes.
That's not something I'm good at. Mm-hmm. And last night, as I was, you know, just getting ready for this morning here with you, you obviously, your brand has alignment with the word peace. Right? Like the word peace and you go hand in hand, per se.
Yes.
And I thought to myself, and I said, can peace coexist with the feelings we don't want to feel?
Right. I think emotions are so important to us that most people who say to me, I'm interested in success, I'm interested in spirituality, in enlightenment, mm-hmm. whatever their search is, it represents to them a way to feel good more of the time and feel bad less of the time,
mm-hmm.
to connect with something. So emotions, I'm not, I don't negate them, but I do recognize that emotions are like weather patterns of the body. They happen to us. They pass through us. And they're changing all the time. If we kept track of our emotions throughout the day, it would be a little happy, a little sad, kind of bored, maybe neutral, maybe a little irritated, something happens. So our feelings change all the time, and a feeling-centered life can be chaotic
mm-hmm.
because those feelings change all the time. And we can't will ourselves to fall in love with someone if we don't like them. We're in love with someone, we can't will ourselves just to stop.
Yeah.
So feelings, we can't will ourselves to change our feeling state in any given moment. There are many techniques people have in neurolinguistic programming and so on to try to change our emotional state. And those are ways to try to influence our emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many ways to influence our emotions. Our posture.
Yes.
How we're breathing, how relaxed we are, looking at things from a more humorous angle. So there are many ways to influence, but the word influence means sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Right.
But control, I don't think so. We can't just by our will change the way we're feeling. The same with thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Thoughts happen to us. They arise in our field of awareness. They just pop into our mind.
Yeah.
We don't say, I think I'll think this thought next. Thoughts just pass through us. And so we don't really have a spam filter in our heads.
Yeah.
Sometimes our thoughts are positive and sometimes they're negative. And I've been around the block. I've done a lot of work in this arena.
Yeah.
And I still have negative thoughts sometimes. So what? I just don't take them as seriously.
Mm.
And that's meditation. The one use of meditation is it gives us some distance and we don't mistake our thoughts for reality.
Yeah.
Because all of us look at life through a filter,
mm-hmm.
like a window. And it's kind of muddied, distorted by our own projections, associations, beliefs. And one of the ideas, one of the benefits of, let's say, introspective practice, inner work, is it helps clear those windows.
Mm-hmm.
So we start to see life as it is, not as we would hope or wish or like it to be, but as it is. And we can respond to reality more appropriately that way, including our own reality.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was actually working on the meditation that you have on the website last night. I didn't get to the entire thing.
Yeah.
The reason this comes up, because you're obviously mentioning meditation, but furthermore, I think I was on part 4 of it, right? Like there's a series of questions that you ask, which, holy cow, Dan. So to bring everyone up to speed, Dan has a meditation, and correct me if you say this differently, but essentially about death, right? And about, you know, experiencing that to an extent, right?
Yes.
And your questions leading up to it were, if you had 1 day, 1 hour, 1 week, 1 month left to live, what would you do? And I'm sitting there on the couch and I'm you know, I'm typing in all the answers as it's coming up. And I'm like, holy cow, like, I need to align my life now with a lot of the things that I'm saying I would be doing here, because I don't always do them. Mm-hmm. You know, the reason I bring all of this up is because why should we meditate on our death?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Because one, all of us are going to die.
Yeah.
And for the young, death is just a distant rumor, as it should be. But it gives meaning to life. Because if we lived 1,000 years, what would that be like? Would we just kick back, watch movies?
People are trying to do that right now.
Well, they're trying to do that, and we'll see. The natural lifespan, maybe they can increase it to 100, 120. But here's the thing. I was attending a lecture decades ago,
okay,
and it was a Zen Roshi. Named Reb Anderson, his name was. A very good Zen teacher, very clear. And after the lecture, I went up to him and I said, Roshi Anderson, can you give me like 2 tips to meditate well? Because I've done some Zazen, I've done TM, you know, some of the popular kinds of meditations and various kinds. And he said, yes, there are 2 things you want to do. First, good posture.
Yes.
He said, you must sit not leaning forward into the future or backward into the past, but vertical in the this present moment. And the second thing you need to do is die. And I knew he didn't mean physically die, but I thought about it later on, because that's all he said. And he meant psychologically die, let go of attachments. And in contemplating that, I said, What if I created a 4-minute meditation, which, by the way, I do almost every day, on the process of dying? Because we have different ideas about death.
Yeah.
Some people believe we ascend to a heavenly realm after death. Our soul ascends. Some people believe we're reincarnated. And there are many different ideas about what happens. But we do know this. Our body decomposes. And so this personality, this physical life, ends at some point, and who knows what happens after. But there are certain things we give up in the process of dying, whether it's very quick or slower. And the meditation on my website, it's one of my online courses. I start, you're mentioning the introduction to get people into this space. Now, you know, how many people say, oh, a meditation on death, I'm so there. You know, most people would rather not, would rather avoid that. But first of all, it helps reduce any fear of death because it becomes familiar, like an old friend. And we do know this, that when we die, we give up time, past and future, even though we might have a past life review. Some people report that. We give up objects. We can't take it with us. We give up relationships. That's one of the hardest for me to go through that step. We give up action. Moving, the ability to move and to have impact in life and have influence over other people. We give up emotions. We give up our senses, whether it's taste, smell, sight, sound, sensation. And when we give up those, we have no sense of being in a body anymore. So going through the meditation, we actually realize, it's a way of realizing very quickly who we really are, which is not somebody who's aware, but awareness itself. And finally, we cut that thread, which is we give up the self, this personality we've developed over time. So that's what this meditation takes people through. And why would we want to do that? Well, I mentioned one reason. It helps reduce fear of death. But the other is nothing I've done has helped me more to appreciate life.
I knew that's what you were going to say.
And what we actually have. We have all our senses. Because we tend to take it for granted. I sometimes ask people, if you woke up tomorrow morning and could fly, soar like Peter Pan, Superman, what do you think you'd feel? And people say things like ecstatic, liberated, elated, delighted. True. I know I would. But after a week, a month, a year, we would be taking it for granted like anything else.
Yeah.
So it's a reminder, a profound reminder. So now I go down the street and I'm just enjoying taking it in. So anyway, that's why I created that particular meditation.
Yeah.
As you know, there's a workout, also a 4-minute workout.
Yes.
So I have several online courses
at
the website.
I'm going to make sure that's linked in the show notes of this audio and on YouTube. But the first piece of advice you got when it came to how to meditate better was to let go of attachment. And I'm going to tie it into what we were talking about earlier in regards to success. When we have the end destination and route, how do we not latch on to that being the outcome? And I'm going to give you an example. The minute this show started, I really, and this was 5+ years ago, almost 6 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
I said to myself, Matt, like, I want this to be the full-time thing that I'm doing. Like, I loved it. Conversations like this, it's a cheat code to life. Dan, if I didn't have the show, I don't know if you and I would be having a conversation like this, right? So I'm being mentored while amplifying. Like, it's such a beautiful thing, you know?
Wonderful thing.
And yeah. So I said at that time, like, I want to have this show in a studio. And little by little, it's gotten here. But along the way and along the journey, I've had to realize that my vision of what the journey would look like might not be how it actually comes true. Right. So how do we let go of the attachment to how we envision things and let them come in the ways that they're coming? Right. Like you get where I'm going with that?
I absolutely
get it.
Well, it's a fact of reality
mm-hmm.
that we cannot control the outcomes in our life.
Yeah.
Whether we sink a putt every time or make a basket or find love or even success.
Mm-hmm.
But we can control our efforts. And by making a good effort over time, we definitely increase the odds of reaching our desired goals over not making the effort. So in a way, effort is success because that's all we can control. Yeah, so that's my approach to life. When I wrote Way of the Peaceful Warrior, I had no idea whether it would ever get published or whether anybody would like it. I mean, Joy thought it was pretty good. So, you know, she always reads my drafts of all my books. And in fact, when the book was published, the editor thought it would be a clever subtitle to call it A Basically True Story.
Mm.
But this is pre-internet days, 1980.
Yeah.
So the bookstores were not amused because they didn't know where to put it. What do you mean a basically true story? Is it true or is it not? Is it in fiction or nonfiction?
Yeah.
And they said, this looks just too weird. I don't know what this way is, peaceful warrior. So very few bookstores even took the book.
Mm.
And it died very quickly. It went out of print. And the publisher gave me back the rights. And I thought I'd had a brief career as a writer.
Mm.
But 3 years later, this old fellow had gotten one of the few copies that were out there, read it, and said, I love this. And he was a retired publisher. And he went back and started a small publishing company, starting with my book.
Wow.
It took him 2 years to get the bookstores, the chains, then Borders and Barnes & Noble, to take one copy in each store. It took him 2 years.
Mm.
But then the word of mouth started. And that is magic. I mean, every author would like to have the word of mouth telling other people, you got to read this book.
Yeah.
But somehow it captured the zeitgeist. And I'm still amazed that people are still excited about reading.
Oh, people are I actually looked this morning. Your book is right here in the neighborhood at Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
I was like, look at that.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
What's a question you wish more people would ask you? Like I said, I watched 5 interviews last night.
Wow.
You do your homework. Well, I had to, right? Yeah. I mean, I have to. Like I said, I mean, we've had a conversation in the past, right? Like homework was done then too. But
sure.
I'm listening to all of these interviews, which were great. They were all great. Shout out to everyone that had the opportunity. But what's a question you wish more people would ask you?
Well, I don't have anything in the forefront of my mind saying, ask me this, please.
Yeah.
I like probing questions. You know,
yeah.
They can even be confrontational. But often I'm asked, what is a peaceful warrior? And I sometimes share the story about how I was teaching a martial arts course at Oberlin,
mm-hmm.
Aikido and Tai Chi. Yeah. Both. So we spent part of the time on Aikido, the basics, the fundamental elements, rolling, falling, break falls, and the basic throws and so on. And Tai Chi, which I practice both to a degree, enough to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to call it for the school catalog, Way of the Warrior. But that didn't quite seem to fit because they're both non-aggressive arts. They're more internal.
Yeah.
They're more receptive. So then a light bulb moment happened, and I went, why don't I call it the Way of the Peaceful Warrior? That would be interesting for the catalog. So when I wrote the book, finally, I thought of that. Hey, why don't I just call it the Way of the Peaceful Warrior?
Yeah.
But really, it's about all of us because we're all seeking to live with that peaceful heart in the midst of the daily news. And it's an interesting times, isn't it?
Absolutely, it is.
And with all the chaos going on, and but there are times we need to find a way to live serenely with equanimity in the midst of that, like being in the eye of the hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
And again, what I mean by warrior spirit is not about fighting necessarily, but about marching into daily life, rolling up our sleeves, and showing that warrior spirit when we need it, in terms of inner strength.
Understood.
Both of those things. So
yeah.
Yeah, about balance.
Do we create peace or do we find peace?
Well, I think both.
Okay.
You know, Joseph Campbell once said, we're here to learn to go with joy among the sorrows of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I first heard that, I thought, that sounds almost callous. Because people are suffering.
Yeah.
You know, people are hurting. Think about the news and so on. But I understood what he meant. Because walking around with a long face, moping around and depressed because of all that's happening in the world, how does that help anybody?
Mm.
So I think in our own relationships with others, people we meet on the street, wish them a good day, say hi, even a smile. You know, sometimes I tell the story about a smile that saved a life.
Mm.
And it's a true story. A woman came up to me after a book signing, and she said, Dan, I want you to know, you know, I'm used to people saying, oh, your book helped me and so on. But she said, I want to tell you a story. She said, I was ready to take my own life. I was convinced no one cared about my life or me at all. I didn't really have many contacts or friends, and so I didn't care either. And she said, I was heading home, and I knew how I was going to do it. And she said, but as I was walking home, I was looking at the sidewalk in front of me, but I happened to glance up, and I noticed a man, a nice-looking man, walking toward me in the other direction. And he gave me this bright smile. And she said, I know it sounds crazy, but I wanted to hold on to that smile for a while. And that smile got me through the night.
Wow.
Because suicide is an impulsive act often.
Yeah.
And the next day she got some help. She spoke with someone. And she was still there and doing much, much better.
That's incredible.
Now that man will never know what his simple smile did.
Mm-hmm.
And so our smile may not save a life, but it might uplift somebody's day.
Yeah.
So little things like that can make a big difference.
Absolutely. One of my favorite books, which I have not read in quite some time, I read it back in college because I felt like I was just very negative, right? I don't think people would have said that, but I think what was going on between the ears was negative. So I Googled, you know, what's a book to read to become more positive? And Norman Vincent Peale's book, The Power of Positive Thinking, came up. I had no clue that this book would be as God-focused as it was, but I picked it up and I read it, and it was great. And do I remember everything from every book I read? Absolutely not. But one thing that I remembered in this book in particular was something along the lines of what you just mentioned. He said, when you are passing someone on the street, say a prayer for them. And I'll tell you, living in New York, you say a hell of a lot of prayers if you practice that because you're passing a lot of people on the street.
Right.
But what a difference, because just being a New Yorker and operating in autonomous mode, or just like kind of, you know, not realizing all of your actions. There's so many times, you know, you get a, I'm 6'5". I get an umbrella in the face if it's raining in the city. And I'm like, oh, you know, give him the bird behind right. the back, you know? But when you say that prayer for someone, like, it changes you so much. And maybe we don't see it because we can't really see energy all the time, but like the energy it gives to that person, it's probably unmatched.
Yeah.
You know?
And then back to your note about feeling positive or being positive.
Yeah.
This idea of positive thinking is an interesting one because on the one hand, we can't really control what thoughts are coming up.
Yeah.
You know, there are people I ask, have you ever read a book on positive thinking? And many hands go up. Mm-hmm. And I go, please keep your hands up if you've only had positive thoughts for the last week or two. All the hands go down. And I just sometimes joke with the audience and I say, but if you probably believe if you'd read the book twice or if you'd highlighted it and done all the exercises, you might have more positive thoughts, less negative ones. Or that might be an idealistic notion.
Yeah.
Because thoughts come and go as they will. And so it's not necessary. What many people mean by positive thinking is really positive living, positive attitude. It's looking at life through maybe, there's a saying, a wonderful Serbian proverb. Two men looked out of prison bars. One saw mud, the other saw stars.
Mm.
And both mud and stars exist in this world. We don't want to deny it or ignore the mud, or we may step in it.
Mm.
But we also want to remember to look to the stars and the positive possibilities, the positive side of things. So I believe what many people mean by positive thinking is really about changing our perceptual filters a little bit, rosier glasses.
Yeah.
Glass, you know, half full rather than half empty. Or give someone a drink. So that's the thing about being positive. On the one hand, we have no control over our thoughts, but we do have control over our behavior. And I was giving a talk at San Quentin Prison, I don't know, 15 years ago or so. And a man came up to me and said, one of the inmates in this Insight program, he said, I have a problem with rage. And he was quite a big guy. And I said, no, you don't. And he said, you don't know me. Yes, I do. And he was getting pretty upset. And I said, no, rage is not a problem. Rage is an internal storm. It's like that weather passing through us. Rage never hurt anybody. But the problem is what you do when you're feeling rage. So now he had a handle on something he could control, which is his behavior. So a lot about the idea of positivity is about giving that smile, about saying that prayer. In fact, since you raised the point, I'm going to share something with your listeners that's a secret spiritual technique.
Please do.
It's called speaking from center. And if you put two guitars, for example, next to one another, and they're both in tune, and you pluck, say, the E string on one of the guitars, the E string will start to vibrate on the guitar next to it.
Mm.
It's called sympathetic or harmonic resonance. And it works the same with the human voice. If you speak from your mind, it will resonate the mind of the person you're speaking with. Nothing wrong with that. But if you speak from your heart, it resonates the heart of that person.
Mm.
It's very subtle. They may or may not notice it. But somehow, after you speak with them, they'll feel somehow a little better. So you can connect your heart, and it's nothing mystical or deep or complicated. Just be aware of your heart as you speak.
Mm.
And that is speaking from center. But more than that, you can connect your heart to your touch. If you're shaking hands with someone or touching them on the shoulder, it's just the conscious remembrance of the heart while you're touching or while you're speaking. And you can also do that with thought. In other words, if somebody cuts in front of me, and you know, and there's many opportunities in Brooklyn to have that happen.
Plenty.
On the sidewalk, or they're driving and they make a turn right in front of you and you jump back. You might not like that personality driving that car, but you can remember there's a soul like me stumbling toward the light.
Yeah.
Maybe they're late. Maybe they have an emergency. Maybe they had a bad day. And you can say to them, you can say to that soul, not the personality, I love you, I support you, God bless you. And the moment you remember to say that, what you were just saying, it's like a prayer, that it's an emotional healing for you, as well as maybe they'll feel that somehow.
Yeah.
So these are subtle things we can do in everyday life. Nobody knows we're doing them.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
How does someone deal with the potential discomfort or maybe feelings of fakeness that might come about if they feel the rage or the anger or the whatever, but they choose not to act on that and do the acting of the heart? right? It might just feel weird. It's like, well, I don't really mean it, you know?
Yeah, I don't really mean it because I'm not feeling it,
exactly.
Right? Yeah. Well, you know, we're often told to trust our feelings, but I don't believe that saying means trust every emotional impulse that arises.
Yeah.
Because then if you're feeling lustful, go have an affair. If you're feeling angry, hit somebody, you know, strike out verbally or, I mean, we'd be pretty crazy if we were trusting every emotional impulse.
Right.
I think what it means is this, and the most controversial thing that I ever say is I don't encourage you or your listeners to feel happy or to feel kind or loving or peaceful or confident or courageous.
Mm.
I only encourage them to behave that way. Mm. And that's based on the understanding that, well, let me put it this way. If there were a storm outside, lots of destruction, God forbid, but lots of destruction, would it be your fault? Would it be my fault? No, it's not a trick question because we can't control the weather.
Right.
If we could control the weather, it would be our responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So we are responsible for what we can control and not responsible for what we can't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very important to be clear on. Because one of the problems with teenagers, let's say, is they feel too responsible for the crazy thoughts they're having and feelings that are going through them, but not responsible enough maybe for what they actually do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true for adults as well.
Absolutely.
And if we don't have, if someone concludes, gee, maybe I don't have direct control by my will over what I'm feeling in any given moment or what thoughts are coming up, that would mean we're not responsible for anything we've ever thought
mm-hmm.
or felt. But we are responsible for what we do. And so people might say, well, that's fine. But back to your question, which was, doesn't it feel kind of fake?
Mm-hmm.
And I ask people in that instance to answer that question, what if you were feeling afraid to run out into the street because the light's not with you, cars are whipping by each way, but you see a toddler, a little kid in the middle of the street, wandered off. And you have to, they're going to get hit. So you find yourself, while being terrified, acting courageously, running out, grabbing the child, and bringing it to safety.
Yeah.
Now, was that fake? Was it hypocrisy? Was it pretense? Or was it a virtue that you were feeling afraid and still showed courage? And the fact is, we can only show courage when we're feeling afraid.
Right.
Otherwise, it doesn't take courage.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, someone can feel shy and walk up to someone and say, hi, my name is, and
absolutely,
what's your name, and meet them. Someone can feel irritated with someone else and somehow find it within themselves to say a kind word to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy because we tend to behave in line with our feelings, in line with our thoughts. And if we feel good about ourselves and happy, it's easier to be kind than if we're feeling lousy about ourselves and unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
But we can still do it.
Yeah.
And that, I believe that our lives are shaped more than anything by what our behaviors over time. And so by focusing, our lives get a lot simpler by focusing on what we need to do rather than, but what am I feeling? Am I having the right thoughts and feelings so I can move forward in life?
Yeah.
That's the complicated way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Dan, I could ask you a million and one more questions, but we're getting close to the clock. I want to make sure that I'm respecting your time. I'm going to squeeze two last questions out of you.
Sure.
This one might be a little bit hypothetical to an extent, right? This is the first time we're meeting face-to-face, second time we're ever engaging. If I knew what Dan knows, how would my life be different?
Well, first of all, you wouldn't be as good at math.
Well, I'm already not good at math. So
maybe that's not knowing what Dan doesn't know. I don't know if it's about what we know. I think it's about what we do. Again, I keep coming back to that. That's like saying, if I were Dan, how would my life be different? Well, your life would look a lot like mine if you were me.
Yeah.
So beyond that, I don't know. Many people who have seen the Peaceful Warrior movie or read my book think, oh, Dan met this old guy in the gas station, a wise old service station mechanic, looked a lot like Nick Nolte. and then he learned some things and now he teaches. But there was a 20-year intensive, 20-year period two decades dedicated to learning, working with four radically different mentors. One I call the professor, one I call the guru, one I call the warrior priest, and one I call the sage. And they had radically different approaches, but it was about the whole spiritual quest.
Yeah,
I write about that in my latest book, which was a memoir called Peaceful Heart, Warrior Spirit. Mm-hmm. So that's how I came to do what I do now, which is my career, my calling, teaching and writing.
Yeah, I love that.
18 books.
God bless.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah. That is incredible. I'm going to make sure the links to where people can get the books is in the show notes. The courses, as mentioned, the meditation that I just purchased last night, which is incredible. What else should we let people know about? What else do you have going on, Dan? Anything else that we should put in the show notes here?
Well, what's a fun thing is if they click on the Life Purpose link, there are several options.
Okay.
They'll go to the Life Purpose Calculator. And if listeners put in their date of birth, they'll get a taste of some rather interesting information about their life path.
Interesting.
And that's free.
Is that astrology based?
Well, yes. It is to do with the date of birth. But there's more to explain about that. I won't now. But it has uncanny accuracy.
Really?
Yeah. And they can go in and get free information. It's called the Life Purpose app. And they can get free information. But if they do, the usual in-app purchase, they get much more details. Everything that's in my book, The Life You Were Born to Live.
Right.
And it's a quantum leap in self-knowledge.
Okay. I'm going to make sure that that's in the show notes as well. That's super interesting. Very quickly, are you into astrology? Because you had mentioned it when we sat down.
Well, it's funny. My wife, Joy, it's been a hobby of hers, calling, if you will. She doesn't do readings for people, but just for family. And she has studied it. But she says, I don't really believe in astrology, but that's because I'm a Capricorn.
That's great.
So I haven't studied it, but this method that I do teach, I call the Life Purpose System, is much more accessible because you have to be really good at synthesizing a whole chart to do astrology or find someone you trust to do that for you. But this system gives a leap in awareness. Yeah,
that's so interesting. I actually did my first reading probably a couple years ago. I mean, I'm born Roman Catholic, so I went to Catholic school my whole life. You're kind of taught hey, it's the Bible and that's it, nothing else.
Right.
I've expanded now to say to myself, well, if God created someone and gave them that ability, to me, that's an open invitation to explore that
all
gift.
Good. That's a broader view.
Exactly.
That's a more Catholic view, actually, a broader view. And people have been striving to understand themselves and other people for many, many years. And there's been many systems, psychology tests, and so on, to understand ourselves. Mm-hmm. And this is one tool that helps us to gain insight into ourselves. I wrote the book so we could have more compassion for ourselves and for other people, knowing there's one journey but many paths.
Yeah.
And we have our own – we're all fighting our own battles. And so it's important to understand, even those people in high school or middle school who were in the elite group, the mean girls and the so-called, popular boys, they were struggling too. They just had better acts.
Mm.
But they had their own battles. We all do. And that helps us to remember to have compassion for other people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Last question for you here.
Sure.
Dan, you put out as many books into this world as you'd like. You have 18. Maybe you double that. You speak on as many stages. You hop on as many podcasts. You do everything you are called to do. You pursue it all. But when someone thinks of Dan, they initially think of one piece of advice attached to your name. What is that piece of advice you want people to remember you for? Which you've given a ton, by the way, just here on this episode. So.
Yeah, I could talk about life purpose. I could talk about living in the present moment. The movie makes a big deal of living in the present moment and the value of that, which we didn't even get into, but maybe we did in our last podcast. Well, to answer that question, I'd like to end appropriately with a brief story about Aldous Huxley, the writer of Brave New World. When he was in hospice care near death, his friend Houston Smith, who wrote the book on world religions, literally that's what it's titled, Houston visited Aldous and said, Aldous, you know, as much as any Westerner of your time, you've studied, you've delved into, not just read about, but practiced a global heritage of spiritual and religious traditions.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any way to summarize all that you've learned? And Aldous looked up at him and said, I'm a little embarrassed to say I can probably summarize it all in about 6 words.
Mm-hmm.
Try to be a little kinder. And I hope if people remember me, it will be Dan was a kind person.
Mm. As mentioned earlier, I mentioned that you're an individual who gives from his heart. So that's how I interpret you. That's how I receive your energy, receive your work. Dan, this has been absolutely incredible. I'm so glad we got to do this face-to-face in person.
Yes.
I'm so glad that you were willing and graciously accepted the invitation to hop back on after 2 years. So just expressing gratitude, thank you so much for what you do and for being here with us.
It's really, truly my pleasure. Thank you, Matt.
Awesome.